making room for a tactical display centered on Terran. The image showed a web of slipspace routes connecting to more than 100 systems, mostly uninhabited, within the designated travel time at a Tarako's best slipspace velocity. Not all the edges of the image appeared to be at the same distance, since slipspace routes ran through the 11 non-dimensions folded into the 4 dimensions perceptible to human beings. The range could actually have been expanded to a 40-hour slip, since environmental conditions such as ambient temperature affected how quickly rigor mortis advanced. But Veda saw no need to complicate things by raising factors that would have no bearing on the investigation. The Tua's mutilated corpses had shown no obvious signs of decomposition when she found them, and given a reasonably warm temperature, putrefaction would have been evident after anything more than 30 hours. Veda pointed at the area of faint color on Yuso's back. It usually takes lividity about 30 minutes to appear, so we know he was left lying at least that long before acceleration began. She studied the lividity on Catalin's back, noticing that it appeared even fainter. And Yuso was killed before Catalin, so he was probably left closer to an hour. The AV specialist touched the wall controls again. The tactical display shimmered as its outer layer vanished, then wavered and expanded to its former size. But this time, it showed only the strands ending in less than a 29-hour slipspace jump. The number of systems in the image had been reduced to fewer than 100. Veda studied the feet of both corpses for a moment, then turned to Crosby.
Doctor, did the feet blanch when you examined them?
Not at all, Crosby said. The lividity was fixed on both patient, victims.
And you squeezed hard.
Crosby looked worried.
Well, I was firm, he said. But I didn't realize.
No, firm is good.
Veda could confirm his findings when she conducted her own examination of the bodies. But the uniform coloring on both sets of feet suggested the blood cells had already begun to break down and dissipate into the surrounding tissue. She turned back to the AV specialist. The lividity is fixed in both subjects. That usually takes between 8 and 12 hours. Given Dr. Crosby's observations and what I can see in the hologram, I'd say we're well into that range. Let's eliminate any system closer than a 10-hour journey. The tactical display wavered again, this time becoming a thick shell of system designator codes wrapped around an empty core. The number of potential search locations dwindled to under 50, still far more than the Silent Joe could reasonably visit. Veda racked her brain for a way to reduce that number still further, and knowing that insects invaded corpses on a predictable schedule, began to wish they had a xenoentomologist aboard.
Dr. Crosby, what did you observe in the way of insect colonization?
Even on Gao, where incubation was considered rapid, it took 14 hours for the first midge larvae to appear.
Was it just eggs, or did you see any larvae?
Crosby's answer was immediate. I didn't observe any of that at all.
Veda frowned. He probably wouldn't have missed any larvae.
They would have been writhing around and fairly obvious. But egg masses often looked like something else.
Did you notice anything that looked like a moldy spot or crusted dirt?
She hadn't seen any colonization herself, but she had been in too much of a rush to make a detailed examination, especially around the eyes, nostrils, or groin.
Crosby shook his head.
No, I'd have taken note of that. There wasn't any.
He paused a moment, then added,
which only makes sense when you think about it.
How so? Veda asked.
Whoever excised the victim's organs did so carefully, Crosby said. And care implies purpose. They wouldn't have wanted insect contamination.
Oh, yeah. Of course, Veda said.
She had been concentrating so hard on establishing a time of death that she had overlooked the connection between motive and location.
They were killed in a sterile environment.
Like an operating room, Ash said.
Probably, Veda said.
But we can't forget that they were held alive for nearly 2 weeks first. So let's say part of a larger facility.
Like a hospital, Ash said.
Or maybe a lab, Olivia said. You're jumping to conclusions. Ash shrugged. Maybe a little bit, he said, but whether it's a lab or a hospital, it's in an inhabited system. Because? Veda asked. Basic counter-surveillance, Ash said. It's easier to hide in a crowd than an empty room. Especially if that crowd happens to live on a world hostile to the UNSC. Camouflage is always smart, Fred agreed. But so is staying mobile. And I've been in enough infirmaries to know that most big ships have surgeons like Dr. Crosby here. Ash thought a moment, then shook his head. A vessel that big is too easy to spot, sir. And it would be likely to draw attention. The UNSC has a lot of anti-pirate assets in the sector right now, Hirsch added. Chances are high that we would have noticed a large vessel in a holding pattern. The room fell silent for a moment. Then Ewan finally nodded. A fine observation, Ash. He looked down the length of the table to the AV specialist. Filter out the uninhabited systems, Petty Officer Hovain. The tactical hologram went almost dark as dozens of designators winked out. With only half a dozen systems still illuminated, the alphanumeric symbols expanded until they were large enough to be easily read, and Veda saw a pair of familiar locations on the list. Venezia, where the Ferret team's mission had begun with the shootout in Trattoria Georgi, was the closest world at 12 hours away. But it was the other location that really leapt out at her. Gao. Her home world was only a 16-hour jump from Terran. And thanks to the inordinate biodiversity of its jungles, it had plenty of laboratories. Developing new medicines was one of its leading industries. It's Gao. The crime scene is on Gao, Veda said. Ewan studied her for a moment, then asked, I suppose you have map coordinates too? Not yet, Veda said, but there are thousands of pharmacology labs there, and most of them have good security and sterile facilities. Thousands, Fred echoed. I liked our odds better before you figured out where to look. I can probably narrow down the list. Veda turned to Crosby. Especially if we can figure out why a research team might want to keep the Tuwas alive for 2 weeks before emptying their chests. Crosby frowned. I can think of only one medical reason to do that before harvesting their organs. A troubled light came to his eyes. The researchers were trying to culture something. Like what? Ewan asked. Crosby picked up his data pad and began to tap the screen. I'll have to run a serological battery to determine the exact nature of those preparations, but I imagine it had something to do with the Barugi incident. Veda had never heard of the Barugi incident, but she recalled that Barugi was the fourth planet in the Tuwa's home system, Tisiphone. Admiral Osman had mentioned that Kirbasi Tuwa had been the medical officer at a preparatory academy located there. What was that about? She asked. Before answering, Crosby cast a nervous look toward Ewan. Her security clearance is higher than yours, Doc, Fred said. He turned to Ewan. And she has need to know, sir. We all do. Fair enough, Ewan said. I'm not even sure why it's been classified, much less compartmentalized. But for the record, nobody talks about it outside this wardroom. Clear? After a chorus of acknowledgments, Ewan nodded to Crosby. Carry on, Doctor. Thank you, sir, Crosby said. 15 years ago, the UNSC Preparatory Academy on Barugi experienced an outbreak of Asteroidea merozoite. Which is? Ash asked. A virulent protozoal disease, Crosby said. Ah, Mark said. That clears things up. The important part is that it was deadly, Ewan said. Extremely deadly. Kirbasi Tuwa and his children were the only survivors. The only long-term survivors, Crosby added. It's also important that this was the first and only known outbreak. That's probably why it was so virulent. How virulent? Veda asked. The entire school was infected within 30 hours, Crosby said. Nearly 10,000 people. And the only survivors were from one family?
Veda's detective radar was humming.
How did that happen?
It's not as suspicious as you may think, Crosby said. They were protected by a gamma thalassemia mutation.
In English, please?
Crosby flashed a good-natured smile. They had a genetic blood disorder that caused a minor deformity in their hemoglobin. The deformity wasn't severe enough to cause symptoms, but it prevented the asteroidea from taking hold.
So that's why the Tuas were held alive for 2 weeks? Veda asked.
Because someone was culturing this gamma the whatever mutation?
Cells containing it, Crosby corrected.
Asteroidea antibodies or antigens. I really won't know until I see the serology results.
But it's definitely related to the Tua mutation, Veda said, pressing the point.
Whatever the kidnappers wanted, they couldn't get it from somebody else?
Crosby returned his attention to his datapad, then nodded.
It does seem to be a unique mutation. The UGD doesn't record it for anyone but Kerbasi and his children.
Veda thought about this. The UGD, the UNSC genetic database, contained the genetic profiles of all non-covert UNSC personnel. The UNSC claimed the database's primary purpose was to speed response time in medical emergencies. But there could be no denying that it was also a great aid in identifying battlefield remains. Something about this whole thing was suspicious. Then it hit her.
None of this was noted in their personnel files, she finally said. I would have remembered it. Actually, the thalassemia mutation was listed in a note in their medical histories, Crosby said. I'd never heard of the gamma variant, and that's what led me to the file on the Barugi incident.
Which was recently classified? Olivia asked.
And compartmentalized.
Crosby checked his datapad, then added, 2 months ago. Olivia lifted her brow. So just 6 weeks before the Tuas were taken? She turned to Veda and added, That can't be a coincidence.
Probably not, Veda said. Let's assume for now that the deaths of Kerbasi and his children had something to do with the mutation. I need a list of everyone who's accessed their files recently.
I'll work on it, Olivia said. But there are probably a million nurses alone who have access to the UGD.
When you add the doctors, medical examiners, and clerks, it's going to be more like 5 million.
Yeah, but the files are still going to have access logs, Veda replied.
Probably, Olivia said, and the ID codes in them are going to be either false or stolen.
How can you know that? Ewan asked.
Because this enemy is too smart to make such a basic mistake, Olivia said. If whoever did this had the ability and the foresight to classify the Barugi incident, then they had the ability and the foresight to access the log using someone else's identity.
True, Veda said, but you'll still need to run it down when you have time.
We need to be sure.
Affirmative.
Veda turned back to Crosby. You said the Tuas were the only long-term survivors, she said. What happened to the short-term ones?
Crosby's eyes dropped to his datapad again.
There were 6 of them, all with delta-beta thalassemia. He seemed to realize he was getting too technical and looked up.
Meaning they had an asymptomatic condition similar to that of the Tuas, but that didn't protect them from the infection. In fact, it caused them to suffer far more.
How so?
When the asteroidea attacked, the mutation caused skin overgrowth and bone malformation.
Crosby looked again to his datapad. In 2 cases, the patients lived in an Oni hospital for several years before finally succumbing to their deformations. They appear to have grown quite grotesque over time. By the end, they barely looked mammalian.
Veda resisted the urge to ask whether the Oni doctors had been trying to save the victims, or just studying them. She wasn't sure she wanted to know the answer.
And that's why the Barugi incident was classified? She asked. Because Oni got involved?
I don't think so, Crosby said. As Captain Ewan suggested,
It's hard to see why someone classified this information at all. Except for Oni's involvement, it's been a matter of public record for 14 years. And Barugi has been under permanent BQ for 12.
It has? Feda asked. Biohazard quarantine was the highest level of quarantine in the human-controlled galaxy, enforced by an orbital net of Hornet thermonuclear mines. She looked to Ewan. Why wasn't that in our assignment briefing?
Ewan spread his hands. Because we didn't go to Barugi, he said. There's a quarantine alert in most navigation packages, and a net of blockade beacons on site. But neither will be triggered unless a vessel shows intention to approach.
And nobody saw the connection to our kidnap victims, because someone buried it in a compartmentalized file.
Veda took a breath, and it did nothing to calm her. Admiral Tua's assassination clearly had been a bold misdirection, an attempt to keep the investigation from focusing on the true targets of the assault.
Wow. They've been one step ahead of us the whole time.
I hate that, Mark said. So who do we kill?
I'm not sure yet, Veda said. But we'll start looking on Gao.
Ewan was quick to raise a restraining hand. Not so fast, Inspector, he said. Gao is still hostile to the UNSC. I can't drop you there on a fishing expedition.
Veda frowned.
Captain. We know the Tuas were held at a lab, most likely on a world hostile to the UNSC. If that doesn't put Gao at the top of the list, I don't know what does.
Being at the top of a list isn't exactly probable cause, Ewan said. I shouldn't have to tell you that.
I'm not with the police anymore. I'm a soldier.
Veda gave him a saccharine smile, then said, besides, we're talking about Gao. An investigator's hunch is probable cause.
Then I need more, Ewan said. I won't risk restarting the insurrection on a hunch.
Veda sighed. She could actually see his point, especially since she had helped Blue Team set off no less than a nuclear explosion the last time they were there.
This is more than a hunch, Captain,
Veda said. It's a circumstantial chain. To begin with, we know that Keeper pirates have been hitting Gao's shipping harder than they've been hitting anyone. There's a lot of bad blood between Castor and Arlo Casile.
Ewan nodded and said, I read the assignment briefing too.
Glad to hear it, Veda said. What the briefing didn't spell out is how cunning Casile can be. He used the UNSC's occupation of the Montero Vitality Center to seize the presidency. He wouldn't hesitate to frame the Keepers of the One Freedom for killing Admiral Tua and her family.
A glimmer of understanding came to Ewan's blue eyes.
And have the UNSC take care of his pirate problem for him, he said. That does make sense.
It's motive, Veda said, which is enough for a search.
At least on Gao. Ewan thought for a moment, then said, for only two.
But thousands of labs? It's impossible to search that many. At least covertly.
We won't have to, Veda said.
She looked down the table toward Anki Hirsch. How precise will your analysis of the tread castings be?
Tread castings? Ewan asked.
Inspector Lopez, picked up some dried mud in the detention center, sir, Mark explained. It probably came from the boots of the guys who planted the Tua corpses.
Ewan eyed Mark with a sour expression.
Mom?
I really hate that nickname.
Veda narrowed her eyes at Mark, then turned back to Ewan. The tread castings will confirm that the operatives Mark and I encountered in the detention center came from Gao. If the analysis is precise enough, we can locate the source to within a kilometer.
We don't have a forensic astrogeologist aboard, Hirsch said. But one of our materials techs is an amateur mineralogist, and we have access to the same botanical surveys that Gao bioprospectors use. We should be able to deliver a competent analysis, but I don't know how much use it will be without a comparative database.
Olivia will get you the database, Veda said.
Olivia looked confused, but said, sure, I guess.
Relax. I still have a friend or two in the Gao Ministry of Protection. They should be able to get you into the GMOP system. Veda looked back to Yuan. That will narrow the search down to no more than a half dozen possibilities, all fairly close together. Good enough? Yuan turned to Fred. Fred shrugged. Good enough for Blue Team, he said. Just tell us who to shoot. Very well then, Yuan said. Assuming the tread castings are from Gao and give us an actionable location, Blue Team will insert. Along with the ferrets, Veda said. We're going in too. Yuan shook his head. Inspector Lopez, you and your team have been through a lot already. Mark and Olivia still have unhealed wounds. We usually do, sir, Mark said. It hasn't stopped us yet. And this is still an investigation, Olivia added. On Gao, sir. How can you not send us along? Ewan's gaze slid toward Veda, and she realized he was thinking about her reluctance to abandon the hostages on Terram, and probably about her reaction to his condescending remarks at the beginning of the briefing. But Veda was not about to apologize. She had to keep her own conscience, and she did not look forward to the day it became easy to leave a dozen captives to be incinerated in their cells. Captain, Veda said, what you said about me earlier, that was wrong. I'm not a soldier. I'm a spy. Yuan held her gaze for a moment longer, then finally said, you've made that apparent, Inspector. He placed his palms on the table, then stood. Very well, then. The ferrets will insert along with Blue Team. But Fred retains command of the mission. Is that clear? That's acceptable, Veda said. Thank you. It wasn't a favor, Inspector. You just made your point. Without awaiting a reply, Yuan turned to Fred. And President Kassil is the head of state of a sovereign world. I don't care what he's done or what your mission is, he will not be eliminated without a prior, explicit order. Understood, Lieutenant? Fred rose and came to attention. Absolutely, sir. He looked across the table at Veda, then said, even Spartans need clearance to start a war. Chapter 18 14:03 hours, December 14th, 2553, Military Calendar. New Leaf Extractions Field Complex, Condado de Jalapea, Yosavi Diversity Reserve, Planet Gao, Cordoba System. The New Leaf Field Complex proved easier to find than Veda had expected. All they needed to do was fly toward the smoke. It was visible from 5 kilometers away. A thick, dark thread rising through a Yosavi jungle canopy that was so lush and familiar, it made her heart ache. Veda loved her ferrets like they were her kid's sister and brothers, and she would never betray their loyalty. But it had been barely 6 months since the friends and colleagues in her GMOP Special Homicide Unit perished in similar terrain, and the thought of their faces could still make her long for home. The thread of smoke swelled into a pillar, and the pillar into a tower, oily and boiling out of a hole blasted down into the jungle canopy. The Turaco slowed and entered the smoke, then began to descend on its anti-gravity pads. Visibility was less than 10 meters, and the nose spun and dipped as the pilot tried to keep watch on the tangle of scorched vines hanging just within view. The insertion team was using the commandeered Turaco out of necessity. The owl they normally used had been destroyed on Terram, and the Silent Joe was too small to carry a spare. Fortunately, the Turaco's new pilot, Taj McAvoy, was a covert services veteran with 2,000 combat hours in an assortment of craft. During the 16-hour slip to Gao, McAvoy had quickly mastered the controls, and he had flown the vessel flawlessly during both the atmospheric entry and the harrowing treetop approach to target that followed. Now he was handling the descent to the jungle floor with a quiet confidence that would have put Veda at ease, had her only worry been landing atop a still-smoldering fire. But unlike the owl, the little Turaco lacked stealth capabilities. It had entered Gao's gravity well under a false transponder code that would not hold up to close scrutiny. and once the Ministry of Aeronautics realized the vessel had vanished from the traffic control system without landing, there was going to be scrutiny. If Veda hoped to find the lead that pointed to the Tuwa's murderers, or what they might do next, she would have to work fast. The Turaco was only 15 meters from the ground when visibility finally improved. Peering over McAvoy's shoulder, Veda saw a hazy, almost park-like setting within a stand of giant cyathia, whose gray trunks were kept meticulously free of moss and vines. Scattered among the immense tree ferns were dozens of cone-roofed buildings connected by a network of cart paths, with dark-rimmed holes melted through their fibroplast walls and roofs. Many of the structures had obviously survived a recent fire. The rest had collapsed and were still trailing ribbons of black smoke into the air. At least 2 dozen human casualties lay scattered across the grounds, about half of them draped in green sheets, and none showing any sign of movement. "Somebody beat us here," Veda said into her headset. "Our first priority will be security," Fred said, also speaking over team comm. "You stay aboard until we control the perimeter." "Negative," Veda said. Fred was in command of the mission. Captain Ewan had reinforced that before allowing Veda and the ferrets to accompany Blue Team. But Veda was still a civilian contractor, and that gave her a certain leeway to be pushy. At least, she thought so. "I'm coming with you. There could be a GMOP Typhoon here any minute." GMOP Typhoons were 3-seat interceptor craft designed to protect Gao's natural resources from biopirates. They had formidable air-to-air capabilities, but what made them truly dangerous were the drones they carried to identify and eliminate targets, hidden deep beneath the jungle canopy. Fred studied her through his faceplate for a moment, then said, "I thought the nearest ministry base was a 2-hour flight." "It is," Veda said. "To protect the jungle ecology, Yosavi airspace was so restricted that even Ministry of Protection craft were not permitted to overfly it, unless they were on a mission. But they would have picked up a blast this big on their satellite surveillance and sent a team to investigate. And who knows how long ago this happened?" "Couldn't have been much more than an hour. Maybe 2, Kelly said. She was standing a few meters behind Veda near the boarding vestibule, along with Fred, Linda, and the 3 Gammas. "The smoke is still thick, which will make it even harder to find any evidence that survived the blast," Veda said. "But someone draped sheets over those bodies, and they might still be around for questioning. That's my job." "Which makes you too valuable to put at sniper risk," Fred said. "You should have worn your armor." "I am wearing armor." Veda tapped her ballistic vest, which aside from her helmet was the only actual armor she was wearing, then said, "battle dress uniform." Fred snorted. "Light battle dress uniform," he said. "And that's not armor. It's more like a security blanket." "It's right for the job," Veda said. She had been issued her own suit of semi-powered infiltration armor during her ferret training, but had left it aboard the Silent Joe in favor of something more appropriate to an investigation. "We're here to question witnesses, not shoot them." "Understood, Inspector," Fred said. "We won't shoot the witnesses." Before Veda could reply, the Turaco stopped its descent so quickly that her knees almost buckled. "Dirtside!" As the pilot spoke, the boarding ramp thunked open, and Veda saw that they were hovering roughly a meter above a large, flat-bottomed crater, filled with still-smoking building rubble. "Dismount!" Fred led Kelly and Linda down the ramp and dropped into the crater. The 3 Gammas followed close behind, the photoreactive panels of their SPI armor shifting from blue-gray to gray-green as they left the Turaco's interior light. As physically enhanced Spartans, they had other forms of armor available to them, but the SPI's active camouflage system was more suited to the stealth often required of ferrets. Veda grabbed a safety handle just inside the doorway and leaned out cautiously to get a better view. All 6 Spartans were already clear of the blast site and racing across the compound in different directions, with her view of the jungle undergrowth blocked by a metal lattice perimeter fence. Veda focused her attention on the crater below.
She did not have much experience with blast forensics, but she knew the basics. There was a lot of black soot, which usually indicated a military or industrial-grade explosive. The crater itself was about 70 meters square, with a network of low ridges creating five circles, one in the middle of the rubble field and one in each corner, so there were actually five craters. All were about the same shape and depth, with similar amounts of rubble from a building piled around their edges. It seemed likely they had been created by five simultaneous blasts. All were flat and shallow, suggesting that most of the explosive force had been directed upward, an impression reinforced by the enormous hole in the jungle overhead. The pilot's voice sounded over Veda's headset.
"I need you back inside, Inspector."
"I'm not going anywhere," Veda said. "I'm just trying to figure out what happened to this building. It looks like the explosions originated inside."
"Makes sense," McAvoy said. "It's hard to make a precision strike through 100 meters of jungle canopy."
"Even with targeting coordinates?"
"The ordnance tends to deflect," McAvoy said. "You need a drone-based delivery system, which isn't all that useful in most other situations. And I still need you inside. The tactical feed is showing a cluster of unknowns coming through the jungle toward us."
"A cluster?" Veda echoed. "How tight?"
"Pretty bunched up."
"They're civilians," Veda said. Even before her Oni training, she had understood small unit tactics well enough to know that a military force would never advance in a tight mass. Not in the face of an enemy armed with grenades and automatic weapons. Probably survivors trying to figure out who we are. Hostiles would be spread out.
"Most likely," McAvoy agreed. "But I still need to protect the craft."
"Understood." Veda started down the ramp and spoke over TeamCom. "Lopez dismounting."
A sigh sounded, then Fred said, "Permission granted." "Ferrets, keep her covered. Blue Team, continue perimeter reconnaissance."
A series of clicks acknowledged the order. Veda aimed for a patch of relatively even ground and jumped off the ramp, then quickly moved away as the Turaco began to rise behind her. The rubble beneath her boots was still warm. It consisted of fist-sized lumps of stone and charred wood, packed into the cavities between masses of concrete held together by rods of twisted steel. Small shards of ash-coated glass blanketed everything, and lumps of melted plastic lay as thick as hailstones. Here and there she saw a scorched limb or a crushed head protruding from the debris, and the smell of burnt flesh hung thick in the air. As Veda drew near the edge of the blast site, the green-blurred silhouette of a Spartan in SPI approached. 8 humans just inside the jungle line at 2 o'clock. Watching us through a fence breach," Olivia said over TeamCom. "Mark and Ash have them flanked."
"No armor. Civilian clothes," Ash said softly. "One 8mm Savine Arms Defender. Otherwise their only weapons are pangas and kitchen cutlery. No obvious wounds. But they look scared out of their wits."
"No problem," Mark added. "If they start to lose it, we'll have them in a crossfire."
"Thanks, Mark," Veda said. She glanced in the direction Olivia had indicated and 30 meters away, saw the breach. Whoever had bombed the New Leaf complex had blasted a gap through the metal lattice security fence. The ground beyond remained clear for 20 meters, then abruptly gave way to an emerald wall of jungle undergrowth. But remember, civilians.
"Scared civilians," Mark countered. "And scared is dangerous. Things can get out of control pretty fast."
"Then let's give them a little time to settle down."
Veda turned away from the breach, then stepped out of the crater onto a feather moss lawn, dotted by chunks of stone and concrete. The soil surrounding each piece of rubble was the same reddish-brown color as the tread castings she had recovered from the detention center on Terram, which was hardly surprising, since the GMOP database had identified the grounds of the New Leaf Field Complex as the probable source of the samples. In all likelihood, the ruined lab behind her had been the location where the Tuas were held for 2 weeks, and then murdered. Logic suggested the bombing had been meant to conceal the identity of the captors, but so far that was just a theory. Before she could develop evidence to support it,
She needed to figure out exactly who had destroyed the lab.
Olivia, walk the crater edge with me. Use your faceplate polarizer and inspect the ground from two angles.
What am I looking for?
Boot prints, Veda said. Whoever set those charges didn't wait inside for the detonation. If we can get a tread pattern, we might be able to match it to a manufacturer.
And match the manufacturer to a supply chain, Olivia finished.
Gotcha.
What's the big mystery? Mark asked. Dark Moon is obviously covering its tracks.
That's an assumption, Veda said. I want something solid.
How about Jirohanai tracks? Kelly asked over TeamCom. Is that solid enough?
I hope that's not a serious question.
Veda turned in a circle and finally located the Spartan about 100 meters away at 10 o'clock. Kelly was a ghostly figure half obscured by a column of smoke, standing next to a collapsed gate.
What do you have?
A lot of signs pointing to a quick, well-organized strike, Kelly said. The attackers used a breaching charge to blow the gate, then entered the compound on foot and started taking down anything that moved. There were at least 5 Jirohanai.
Doesn't mean I'm wrong, Mark said. Dark Moon used Jirohanai to hit the Denoma and kill Admiral Tua.
Because they wanted us to think it was a keeper operation, Veda said. But why would Dark Moon use that same deception here?
We already know the keepers were framed for the Denoma incident, and that Dark Moon was the muscle for the kidnapping and the murders.
I think it was the keepers who made this attack, Linda said. There are Kigyar tracks at another fence breach in the back of the compound. Probably a team of 10.
And we have boot tracks here, Olivia added. She was kneeling a few steps ahead of Veda, her helmet close to the ground and turned toward the crater.
Looks like it was 2 men, running from a fence breach toward the lab building.
There was no sidewalk or even a footpath crossing the feather moss in the area, so the men had been approaching a window rather than a door, which meant they had probably been part of the assault team, rather than employees running for shelter.
This is looking more like a raid than a cover-up, Veda said. It doesn't make sense that it was Dark Moon. If they held the Tuas here for 2 weeks, they would have a relationship with the staff. They wouldn't need to breach the fence in 3 places and force entry.
So, keepers? Fred sounded reluctant. That's hard to believe after their losses at Salvation Base.
Not really, Veda said. We know they have other bases, and several vessels escaped Terran before the nukes detonated.
Maybe Castor was on one.
Yeah, Castor, Fred said.
He and Veda had both done battle with Castor here on Gao, and knew what a ferocious warrior he was. And during the second debriefing, Veda had described how she had locked eyes with Castor just before he took the wounded Dark Moon operatives and fled. After a moment, Fred exhaled sharply.
Son of a... You're thinking he did this?
It would account for a lot, Veda said. Especially if Castor kept those Dark Moon operatives alive long enough to interrogate them. We know from the tread castings I found on Terran that they were here. They were probably telling Castor all about New Leaf while we were still waiting for Ewan to debrief us.
That would explain how the Keepers beat us here, Kelly agreed. And Jirohanai aren't the kind to hole up after taking a hit. Castor would want to strike back.
Probably, Veda said. She turned and studied the crater. The building had been more than simply destroyed. It had been demolished so thoroughly it was hard to tell it had once been a laboratory. But there's more to this raid than just that.
Like? Fred asked.
I'm not sure yet.
Veda started toward the nearest fence breach.
I'll let you know after I talk to some witnesses.
Affirmative.
Fred sounded more resigned to her plan than approving of it. Just don't get shot.
She won't, Mark said. At least not first.
Nobody's getting shot, Veda said. Is that clear?
If you say so, ma'am, Mark replied. We can always go hand to hand.
Veda exhaled in frustration. Olivia fell in beside her.
He's just worried about you, Mom.
Veda frowned into Olivia's bubble-shaped faceplate.
Aren't you supposed to be looking for tread patterns?
Olivia shrugged.
I'm worried about you too, she said. This is Gao, and you're wearing a UNSC uniform. You should have worn your armor.
They've got knives and a SAD 8, Veda said. The 8mm Savine Arms Defender was a short-nosed weapon designed for easy concealment and close-quarters self-defense. Its recoil was so heavy that even experienced shooters had trouble hitting a target at 10 meters. So Veda wasn't that concerned.
I'll be fine.
Of course you will, Olivia said. I'll have you covered. They reached the fence breach. Veda removed her utility belt with its holstered sidearm, then wrapped the belt around the weapon and passed the bundle to Olivia.
Hold this.
Olivia reluctantly shifted her battle rifle to one hand and took the belt.
It's hard to react with my hands full.
You'll do okay, Veda said, and you'll look less intimidating. Veda stepped through the breach and, holding her hands away from her sides, started across the clearing toward the wall of undergrowth. When she was 5 meters away, a husky female voice called out,
"That's close enough."
"No problem.
I just have a few questions," Veda said.
"And you expect us to answer?"
"Us. Not me," Veda noticed.
The woman behind the voice wasn't accustomed to being in charge.
"I'd appreciate it."
"Guess Spartans aren't that bright."
"Do I look like a Spartan?" Veda asked.
The voice fell silent for a moment, then said,
"Your friends do. You look like a traitor."
Veda's chest tightened. She had joined the enemy not because she was a traitor, but because the planet's new president, Arlo Casile, could not be trusted with the powerful forerunner Ancilla that she and Blue Team had recovered in the Montero cave system. But the woman in the jungle could not possibly know that. Casile had classified all information related to Forerunner discoveries on Gao, then publicly declared that Veda, a brave investigator, had died during the fight to drive off the UNSC. But he hadn't plastered her picture across the media. So unless the woman happened to recognize Veda from a 6-month-old news feed, she was probably basing her traitor remark on Veda's Gao accent alone.
"Do we know each other?" Veda asked.
"I know you're kind," the woman said. "The watchdog warned us. You want to be ashamed, helping the UNSC kill your own people." The watchdog. That had to be Arlo Casile's new nickname. Probably one he had created himself to secure his hold on power. Veda stepped closer to the jungle line. "If I wanted you dead, those Spartans on your flanks would have done the job by now." A rustle sounded as Mark and Ash made their presence known, and a chorus of gasps sounded from the undergrowth. "Come out here where we can talk," Veda ordered. "Tell me what happened." A stocky woman of about 40 emerged from the fronds. She had a round face and short auburn hair, and she was holding a meat cleaver in one hand. Her embroidered blouse was so smeared with moss and mud that it looked like camouflage. A name tag stitched into the left chest panel read, "Nita." Nita gave Olivia a disdainful once-over, then stopped in front of Veda and put her free hand on her hip.
"You know what happened. The UNSC sends the keepers in to do its dirty work, and now you're here to clean up."
The woman sounded like a true Casile loyalist, a sucker for propaganda and conspiracy theories. Veda paused for a moment, adjusting her approach, then spoke in a calm, factual voice. "The UNSC had nothing to do with this." She made a point of looking into the undergrowth behind the woman, then said, "We haven't found any of your wounded."
"So?"
"So there must have been some," Veda said. "Is there anything we can do for them?"
"Not likely."
Nita's expression remained hard, but her tone was softening. "They're at the evacuation pad by now." There was an emergency evacuation pad 10 kilometers away, which served several laboratories similar to New Leaf. McAvoy had originally planned to land the Turaco there, but had diverted to investigate when he saw smoke rising from the coordinates of their final destination.
"Are you sure it's safe?" Veda asked,
That evacuation pad is the only place the Keepers could have landed a spacecraft.
Don't worry, Nita said. It's safe.
She looked unconcerned, which suggested enough time had passed for her to be certain the Keepers were completely gone. Call it 20 minutes for someone to drive out on the dirt road and report back. Then another 30 or 40 minutes to get organized and transport the casualties to the evacuation pad. But it really didn't matter how long the Keepers had been gone. Their vessel could easily have been spotted by traffic control as it left, or even on approach. Really, a GMOP patrol could show up at New Leaf any time. Veda smiled at the woman, then said, "Glad to hear it. I just have a few questions and we'll be on our way." Nita's face showed relief. "Then ask away. The sooner you're gone, the better." "You're sure it was the Keepers of the One Freedom who attacked?" "I know a brute when I see one," Nita said, "and they were wearing Keeper armor. Blue with gold trim." Nita was suddenly volunteering information. She was eager to get rid of the UNSC. Continuing in a casual voice, Veda asked, "What did they want?"
"How should I know?"
The woman looked into the undergrowth behind her, a body language deflection that suggested a lie.
"Miguel, can you believe this? She's asking us." "Maybe it's the same thing they're looking for," said a male voice.
The undergrowth stirred, and a hawk-nosed man in rubber boots and muddy khakis stepped into view. The grip of the Sad Eight protruded from his front pants pocket.
"Has to be." "Good thinking."
Nita turned back to Veda, then said, "Maybe we should be asking what you want." "Answers." Veda watched Nita and Miguel shoot uncertain glances at each other, then knew what her interrogation strategy would be. She continued to hold Nita's gaze.
"What do you think we're after?"
Nita gave an exasperated shrug.
"No idea. I'm just a cook. He's a groundskeeper." "Damn."
Veda dropped her chin in feigned disappointment, then turned away and spoke loudly into her headset mic. "Alpha Team, is the perimeter secure?" "Who the hell is Alpha Team?" Fred's reply came over TeamCom and would not be audible to Nita, Miguel, or any of the Gao survivors. "And why are you being so loud?" "Good," Veda said, ignoring Fred. "It looks like we're going to be here a while. Set mines and motion detectors, then clear an LZ for the forensics teams, a big one. We're going to need the M606.
"The what?"
Fred hissed in Veda's ear.
"There's no such thing."
"What's an M606? Nita asked. "Armored track shovel," Veda said. "The recovery crews are going to need it to dig out the lab."
"Why would you do that?" Miguel asked.
"Because you're just a groundskeeper and she's just the cook." Veda nodded toward Nita. "Neither of you seems to know what was really going on at New Leaf. So we're going to have to find the answers ourselves. That means excavating the lab."
"The Ministry of War will never allow that," Nita said.
Veda glanced at Olivia and rolled her eyes. Olivia snorted through her helmet's acoustic transducer and asked,
"You think they can stop us?"
Nita's face paled, and Miguel said, "Just
tell them, Nita. What difference does it make now?"
"Good idea." Veda kept her gaze fixed on Nita. "This doesn't have to be hard. But I'm going to have my answers before we leave. If that means staying here a week, okay?"
"Okay,"
Nita said. "But we are just hired help. I don't know how much we can really tell you."
"Start with what you think has been going on here," Veda said, "and don't waste time lying. Once that M606 is loaded, the task force won't be turning back."
"All we know is what we heard," Miguel said, forcing Nita's hand. "The White Coats were working on something to stop the Keepers from harassing Gauss shipping."
"A biological agent?"
"What do you think?" Nita retorted. "This is a lab."
Veda sharpened her tone. "So you were developing biological weapons at this facility?" Knowing that Miguel was the more nervous of the two, and therefore the more cooperative, she switched her gaze to him. "In violation of the Ganymede Accords." "There was no such official agreement,
but Miguel's face fell anyway.
Not us, he said. And we haven't even been inside the main building for 2 weeks.
Miguel, Nita said, if the watchdog hears you've been talking...
Veda interrupted. Trust me, Nita. You don't want to interfere with this investigation. She continued to look at Miguel as she spoke. If we find out you've been party to violating the Ganymede Accords, we'll have no choice but to take you along when we leave.
For what?
For prosecution. Crimes against humanity, Veda said. Covering for someone else makes you a conspirator, and we have no leeway in the matter. So be careful here. The ride home is going to be crowded enough.
You can't take me anywhere, Nita said. I'm a gout.
We know exactly who you are. Veda glanced toward Olivia, who responded by stepping up close to Nita, then said, but the UNSC takes the Ganymede Accords very seriously.
Look, we didn't have anything to do with it, Miguel said. 2 weeks ago, the service crews were banned from going inside the lab.
Did that ever happen before?
No,
Miguel said.
This is the first time.
Where's the rest of the staff now? Veda asked. The researchers and the managers.
All dead, Miguel said.
He pointed through the fence breach toward the collapsed lab building.
Most of them, anyway.
We tried to dig out everyone who was still alive and sent them to the evacuation pad. But a lot of them aren't going to make it.
Veda was sorry to hear of the casualties, but she couldn't say so without undermining her interrogation persona.
How long ago?
How long ago what?
Miguel asked.
Look, Nita added, we've told you everything we know. Maybe you should load up and let us get back to collecting the dead. I'm sure you noticed the bodies still stuck in the rubble.
I'll decide when we're done, Veda said. How long ago did you send the wounded to the evacuation pad? Miguel looked to Nita, and Nita sighed and checked her chronometer.
Over an hour ago, she said. They should be in the air by now.
Everybody catch that? Lopez asked over team comm. The wounded are being airlifted out of the evacuation pad. Repeat, medevac. Give them safe passage. There was a short pause. Then McAvoy spoke over team comm.
The Silent Joe reports negative traffic over the Yosavi jungle. A medevac could have set down at the emergency pad before we inserted and still be on the ground. But there's nothing in the air right now.
Copy. Veda looked back to Nita and decided not to press her on the timing of the evacuation flight yet. There could be a lot of things holding up the departure, and Nita wouldn't know about any of them. Instead, she turned toward the fence breach.
Tell me about the raid.
She motioned for everyone to walk with her toward the blast site. What did the keepers do when they arrived?
You have to ask, Nita snapped, clearly impatient. They started killing everyone in sight.
And blowing shit up, Miguel added. They hit the admin office and the director's hut right away. They reached the fence breach and started toward the demolished lab crater.
What about the lab? Veda asked.
Did they hit the admin office and the director's hut on their way? Or did they search the rest of the compound first?
No. A bunch of them went straight to the lab, Nita said. They blew the windows and doors and went inside.
And then what happened?
Don't know, Nita replied. By then we were hiding in the jungle. If we hadn't been, you wouldn't be talking to us now.
How long did you stay hidden? Veda asked.
Not long, Miguel said. The keepers went inside the lab. We heard some gunfire and maybe 10 minutes passed. Then they left in a hurry. They were barely out the gate before the whole building blew.
So they knew what they were after and where to find it, Veda surmised. Did you see if they took anybody?
Just Director Sabara, Miguel said. At least that's what some of the wounded were saying. They didn't talk about anyone else being taken.
What about sample canisters? Veda asked. If Director Sabara had been using the Tua's living bodies to culture something from the thalassemia mutation, the keepers would certainly be as interested in that as in the lab staff's knowledge. Castor might not be a scientist himself, but he was a cunning warrior who knew the importance of collecting hard intelligence.
Did you see them take anything like cryo jars?
How could we? Nita asked. We told you. We didn't see anything.
She was trying a little too hard to draw Veda's attention, which probably meant she knew more than she was telling. Veda kept her gaze fixed on Miguel. Nita is walking the conspirator line, Miguel. Care to join her? Miguel shook his head. The cryo jars were already gone.
Miguel!
Nita shot him a warning look. She was asking if the keepers took the cryo jars.
So?
Miguel scowled right back at her.
You can cover for him if you want to, but I'm not violating the Ganymede Accords for anybody.
That's very wise of you. Veda took her helmet and utility belt back so Olivia's arms would be free to restrain Nita, then asked Miguel, what happened to the cryo jars?
Some guys took them before the keepers came, Nita said, still trying to keep Miguel from answering. And then they left. Maybe you should do the same.
You can still recover from this, Veda said, if you start cooperating. Ever hear the name Dark Moon?
Those kinds of guys?
Nita's eyes flashed in alarm. Then she sighed and nodded.
Yeah. Director Sabata mentioned that.
She had me cook them a late supper.
Last night?
Of course last night. When do most people eat supper? Veda glanced at Miguel and furrowed her brow.
They took off in the middle of the night, he said. Their truck made so much noise it woke up the whole compound. I got up and saw the cryo jars in back.
Where were they going?
No idea, Nita said. I was supposed to make them breakfast, but they were gone when I got up. The kava pan was a mess.
Interesting. Kava was a bitter local drink with stimulant properties. People sometimes chewed the leaves raw, but they were usually boiled in a pan with guado nectar.
So the Dark Moon team was Gao? Veda asked.
Nita shook her head.
No, but they were here a while, and they developed a taste for kava. They came with the original crew.
Would that have been 2 weeks ago? Veda looked to Miguel, when Director Sabara closed the lab to the service crews.
Yeah, that's about right, Miguel said, and they were always walking the perimeter, especially in the rain. It messed up the lawns.
They sound like Ganymede conspirators to me, Olivia said. Too bad we missed them.
Very bad, Veda agreed. It sounded like someone had warned the Dark Moon crew about the blown operation on Terram, and they had left Gao in a hurry. The keepers are way ahead of us.
You're thinking they took Sabara for interrogation? Fred asked. Like the rest of the team, he was monitoring the conversation over team comm. And she knows where the Dark Moon team is taking the cryo jars?
I think it's a strong possibility, Veda said. As the conversation shifted to team comm, Nita and Miguel were eavesdropping on her end, listening intently to whatever she said into her headset mic. The keepers found what they came for, or they wouldn't have left in such a hurry. And they destroyed the lab for a reason. My guess is they didn't want anyone else to pick up the trail.
The channel remained silent for a moment, then Kelly said what was running through everyone's minds.
I'm worried about those cryo jars.
Could this be developing into a code Hydra problem? With the keepers in the middle of it?
Hydra was the UNSC emergency code for an imminent bioweapon threat.
It could be, Veda said. But for now, I'm not sure the keepers know what they're getting into. I think Castor just wants to find out who set them up.
The same as we do.
It's not that hard to figure out, Mark said. Look where we are. It has to be Cassiel.
I'm sure President Cassiel is involved up to his ears. He's getting something out of it.
As Veda spoke Cassiel's name, Nita and Miguel both widened their eyes. But I don't think he set it in motion. If he had, we would have found a company of battle jumpers guarding the place when we arrived. And the keepers would have too. They'd be dead, not ahead of us.
I'm not worried about the keepers, Fred said. Where the hell are the cryo jars?
Unknown. Veda sighed and studied the rubble in front of her, searching for inspiration that would not come.
I need some time to look for answers. Damn it, Lopus, Fred said. We don't have time. If there's any chance that this thing is turning into a Code Hydra problem, we need to recover those cryo jars now.
I understand that, Lieutenant,